It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Trump administration announced this week that the USDA will make $12 billion available in one-time payments to farmers impacted by international trade disruptions.
It could provide some relief to Wisconsin farmers who faced financial losses this year due to retaliatory tariffs and lost trade partners.
Eligible farmers will find out later this month how much assistance they can receive. The payments are expected to be released by the end of February. Meanwhile, as part of trade negotiations, China has agreed to purchase some U.S. soy, but the Trump administration this week said the timeline has moved back from the end of this year to possibly February.
We're checking in on what kind of impact this could have on farming in our state and whether relief payments can make up for the losses farmers have felt this year.
Doug Rebout is a Janesville farmer and president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Doug, we've been talking to you over the last early couple of years about the impact of not just tariffs, a lot of economic factors. Can you give us a quick reminder of what kind of challenges soy farmers in Wisconsin have faced from the trade war?
Yeah, with everything that's been going on and China not taking any soybeans for so long, that has really impacted our markets. And at a time when we were harvesting and a lot of the crops getting sold. And, you know, with China, they historically have taken 67% of the soybeans that the U.S. exports. So, I mean, that market is huge to us. And so, and it all happened at a very bad time for us.
As I mentioned, China, at least now, is on track to get some soy from the U.S. Do you see things turning around? Is this happening fast enough to make a difference for this year's harvest?
Well, again, I mean, we're very appreciative of the trade deal, but, you know, for the year 2025, they said they would take 12 million metric ton. And I think so far they've taken about 3 million. And again, like I said, most farmers have sold their crops, you know, during harvest, because if you don't sell them, then you got to pay for storage and it just costs more. So, I mean, it helps, yes, and we appreciate anything we can get, but we're hoping for more, and we're hoping for those soybeans to actually get shipped over. There's been an agreement, but as far as I know, nothing has been signed, and, you know, so there's nothing holding China to this deal right now.
Okay, here comes this relief funding announced this week now, $12 billion. The bulk of that, I think $11 million meant for commodity producers, commodities like soy. How much spread out throughout the country and all the producers, how much help will that be?
You know, until they come out with exact numbers and how the payments are coming out and who qualifies, it's hard to answer that question. And right now, you know, the payments are supposed to come out in February, but farmers right now are sitting here going, okay, this is generally the time where we have our loans that are coming due. We have our land rents that are due, and we're buying our inputs for next year. And so with all this uncertainty, we're still sitting here going, we don't know what to do, because this money has been, you know, or they've said, okay, we're going to put this money out, but no one knows how or how much or how they're doing it. So that's the part right now that farmers, you know, we're appreciative that there's going to be something, because farmers are in financial struggle right now. But we're looking for some certainty.
We had a statement from the Wisconsin Farmers Union out this morning, quoting a little bit of it here. While this one-time assistance will help many Wisconsin producers stay afloat in the near term, emergency payments alone cannot address the deeper issues pushing family farms to the brink. They go on, the current farm safety net is outdated and not equipped to match today's economic pressures, from record input costs and unstable markets to the rising burden of healthcare on rural families. So all that on top of the tariffs we're talking about, Doug, with that uncertainty you were talking about, are you hearing from your fellow Soybean Association members like, hey, we're not sure if we could stay in business or we might have to change what we're doing next year?
Yeah, I mean, farmers have been, you know, we've been saying that for a long time, that, you know, we know some banks are not, you know, guaranteeing loans to some farmers because of what's going on. And also without having the farm bill and the certainty of, you know, the programs that come with that. And so, yeah, there are farmers that over the last few years, you know, the prices have not been that great. And the farmers have been going, you know, into their reserves, and we can only do that for so long. And so, yeah, there are farmers that are really struggling. There's farms that are going out of business, and that's something we don't want to see.
I want to pick up on something you just mentioned there, Doug, the loans and the banks. The flow is you borrow money to plant, basically, and you pay it back with the revenue from the harvest. How big a problem is financing right now if there's that uncertainty and banks are saying, hey, we don't know if these products are going to sell enough to pay these loans off come harvest time?
Yeah, that's something that the banks have to look at, and they're being a lot more cautious. I mean, every farm is different on, you know, depending on what their debt load is and everything, and, you know, how they've done in the past, how long they've been in business. So we don't want to loop all the farms into one category. Every farm is, you know, totally different. And, you know, I would not want to be in the banker's shoes and going around and trying to figure out, okay, what farms can we, you know, loan money to? What farms can't we? And, you know, be that banker that go to that farm and say, I'm sorry, you're not in good enough financial position for us to loan you money. I would not want to be in that position.
Doug Rebout is with us, Janesville farmer and president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association, talking about the impact of tariffs and trade disputes on the soy industry here in the state and some relief funding promised from the Trump administration. Doug, looking ahead at the market for soy, I was just seeing China had record imports of soy this year. But wait a minute, sounds like they're not coming from the United States. A lot of it coming from Brazil. Trade war ends tomorrow. Are you concerned that, hey, the market flow, these deals inked between China and Brazil means the China business wouldn't come back to the U.S. anyway?
Yeah, that's been a fear of ours for a long time because, you know, China, like I said, they've historically bought a lot from us, but they've transferred a lot of that purchases from South America now, and that infrastructure is set up. And, you know, yes, if this trade war ended tomorrow, they're not going to go, oh, okay, trade war is done, we'll come back to you. It's going to take a long time to get those markets back and, you know, build up that trust and everything. I mean, we do have a better quality bean, you know, crops. That is something that we do have going for us than what South America is selling. But it still comes down to price and that infrastructure that's already set up.
I assume that the Soybean Association, farmers, others have been looking for alternate markets to China. Where is soy going when it hasn't gone to China over this last year?
Well, we're trying to open markets all across the world. Again, to make up that 67%, that's very tough to do. And another thing that we really want to do is find more domestic uses right here so we don't have to rely on foreign markets. And so, you know, we're hoping that the government can, you know, do things with this 45Z program that's out there that regulates and tax incentives for soy or for oils coming in, used oil coming in from other countries, and also to come out with the numbers for the renewable fuel volumes. Those were supposed to come out on October 31st, and we have not seen anything, you know, with the government shutdown. So if we can get some of these numbers and some policies to help us with domestic use, then we don't have to be so reliant on foreign markets.
With those foreign markets, uncertainty has been, I think, the watchword most of this year. The U.S. does something, China, other countries retaliate, and so on. When would you want to see certainty? When would soy farmers in Wisconsin want to see certainty so that they can really lock down plans for 2026? What's kind of a deadline?
Right now. Because we're working on our 26 crops right now. We're buying our inputs. We're buying our seed. We're buying our fertilizer. We're marketing the 2026 crop already, you know, for on future contracts and stuff. So I mean, so when I say we need, you know, certainty right now, that's not a joke. That is something that we need. Because we need certainty not just for the 26th year, but 27, 28, and, you know, 5-10 years down the road is what we need, because that's, as farmers, that's what we're looking at. We're not just looking at this next year. We're looking at multiple years of what we're doing when we plan our crops.
Doug, like you said, not every farm is the same. I've talked to some farmers who do some commodity soy, some commodity corn, or lots of soy and small amounts of specialty crops. Are people in soy right now thinking, hey, I need to take the balance away from soy and do a little more of something else?
Yes. I mean, just in the year 2025 in Wisconsin alone, there was 250,000 less acres of soybeans planted than in 2024. And as, you know, we're sitting here looking at and planning for the 2026 year, I'm sure that number is going to drop again because, you know, with the price of soybeans, you know, farmers are going, okay, I'm going to, you know, there's more certainty in the corn market, so I'm going to go and plant more corn. But the problem I see there is, okay, farmers plant less soybeans, plant more corn. Well, then we're going to have a surplus of corn, and is that going to drive the corn market down then?
Doug, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you.
That's Doug Rebout, Janesville farmer, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association. He is with us today to look at the potential impact of new financial aid payments from the Trump administration for farmers who have been negatively impacted by international trade disputes. We talking about you? Is this your business, your livelihood? Are you feeling the uncertainty we've been talking about? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Up, the Trump administration is overhauling grants that provide funding to combat homelessness, now focusing more on short-term housing. What could this change mean to Wisconsin?
That could lead to dramatic numbers of people currently housed losing their housing and being ineligible for support.
Hear from leaders who work on housing insecurity in Wisconsin. That's next. The Trump administration plans to make changes to a federal program that provides permanent housing for people who are homeless and instead prioritize short-term housing coupled with work requirements or addiction treatments.
In November, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced its new plan for the program called Continuum of Care, slashing support for permanent housing programs by more than half. Wisconsin then joined a multi-state lawsuit challenging those cuts.
Then, on Monday, HUD put its changes on hold just before a court hearing in that case, but promised it would issue a revised plan soon.
The agency said it wants to make money available to grantees with measurable results, but that it was still committed to making, quote, long overdue reforms to its homelessness assistance programs.
To learn more about this program and what potential cuts would mean, we're joined by David Nelson, chair of the board of directors of the Milwaukee Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. David, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me today.
And Tim Bach is here, president and CEO of Pathfinders. It's a nonprofit in Milwaukee providing emergency or transitional housing to Milwaukee youth and young adults. Tim, welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
David, starting with you, as you head up a coalition that works with Milwaukee agencies that receive this federal continuum of care funding, how would cuts to this program affect the shelters and the organizations your coalition works with in Milwaukee?
We receive currently about $15 million in our city and our coalition to help people that are on the streets and people who are at risk for being on the streets in a variety of circumstances and identities. And there's currently, it's not enough money, all right? And I'll say that if there are cuts to the program and the way that that program is being administered, it's going to put a serious dent in how we continue to attack this issue.
What might be one of the things that goes away?
Well, one of the things that the current administration is planning on is that they're moving away from a housing first model. And a housing first model says that we provide supportive housing for people first and then give people choice and dignity in the services that they need to become positive citizens again, rather than being unhoused. And the other thing that it will do is that it will decrease the amount of permanent supportive housing. And in other words, it will be a time-limited feature for people. And we all want people to be positive citizens in our community, yet we know that it's not one size fits all people.
Tim, your organization, Pathfinders, also receives this funding. How would these funding cuts affect your youth that you serve?
Well, we are certainly very concerned with the impact on our entire system and likewise on our entire state. I mean, this is a pretty dramatic shift that HUD is proposing in its most recent notice of funding opportunity. And as David noted, it shifts what is currently the majority of funds in our community and really across the country from being categorized as permanent supportive housing into very time-limited and restricted housing. Right now, about 90% of projects that are funded under the HUD NOFO, the Notice of Funding Opportunity, do provide permanent supportive housing. And as David also noted, that is housing with supportive services as a key component of why that housing is successful. And it moves that permanent supportive housing to no more than 30% of allowable projects, which is a significant shift in very short order that will have dramatic impacts on the number of people that can be served. And as importantly, with HUD's current definition of homelessness, what defines somebody as eligible for support under a continuum of care funded project, that eligibility criteria will in effect make most people who are currently in permanent supportive housing ineligible for the transitional housing that HUD expects to take its place. And so that could lead to dramatic numbers of people currently housed losing their housing and being ineligible for support as the projects try to move into a more temporary transitional model, should the regulations that HUD is proposing actually be allowed to be implemented.
Why, Tim, is housing so critical for the young adults that you work with in Pathfinders? Why is housing such a key piece?
Yeah, that's a great question. We believe in terms of the lifelong homelessness and housing instability that many older adults experience, we believe had there been proper resources and support provided early on, that there's this window of opportunity to stop that trajectory and that lifelong experience of homelessness. You know, many people who are currently in HUD-funded programs are what is called chronically homeless. And that means really a defined period of time, and often that is many, many years of housing instability and homelessness that people experience. We have an opportunity to intervene earlier, and as David mentioned, to do more upstream prevention work to really change that narrative for folks. You know, about half of the young people that we currently serve in our supported housing portfolio programs here in Pathfinders are actually head of household, and they are parents of young children. Mm. And so there is an intergenerational aspect of homelessness and housing instability that also needs to be taken into account. And I think there is, for us, this opportunity to intervene earlier and to do more upstream prevention so that we don't wait for people to be older adults and still experiencing homelessness and often trying to survive on the streets.
Trying to stop that cycle early on in their lives. Tim Bach is with us, CEO of a youth homeless shelter in Milwaukee County called Pathfinders. David Nelson here, chair of the board of directors of the Milwaukee Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. David, how effective has this Housing First policy model been in addressing this issue in Milwaukee and elsewhere in the state?
When you have stable housing, you can have more likely have better healthcare access, access to education, community connections, and economic status. So it builds on one another. And so our community, the Milwaukee area, and the state of Wisconsin has adopted Housing First as the evidence-based strategy in order to prevent people from returning to homelessness. And I've looked at the literature on this, and the literature is unequivocally clear that Housing First does work. You know, the challenge that we're faced with around homelessness is it's not necessarily a binary. So in other words, it's not a yes or no, but it lives on a continuum from people who are unhoused, people who are living in places that are not fit for habitation, to people who are at risk for being unhoused. And there's a variety of factors that go into that. And so the idea that you can just provide the idea of a limited housing means that you might not be able to address other social issues and personal issues that people have. What we're afraid of is this a revolving door of people returning to homelessness after a short time in housing.
And you know, critics have said that this Housing First model has failed to address the rising death rates among people who are homeless and have, for instance, fentanyl addictions. Has this policy approach failed at its goal of getting people housed when they do have other issues in their life?
You know, if we want to talk about policies, the policies that have been put forth by previous administrations has not really lent itself to supporting a complete end to homelessness. And of course, it's our goal. But the idea that we're going to end this when we know that we don't have enough mental health providers, we don't have enough places for people with serious mental illness to go, as well as treatment centers for people to thrive. We have plenty of cases in Milwaukee and plenty of examples of people who have done well, who have beaten addictions. But at the same time, the insidious nature of addiction means that it is also a demand issue. And so the idea that we're going to end a demand for substances is not only short-sighted, but it misses an opportunity to make a difference like we have been doing in our city.
Tim, you've described current funding levels for youth homeless shelters as being historically underfunded. Is this underfunding a failure at the federal level? Is it a state of Wisconsin not providing enough funding here? Where is the core of the issue?
That's an important question. I think for myself, it's a both and. We have long advocated for increased federal funding that targets, in particular, runaway and homeless adolescents, as well as youth transitioning into adulthood. Similarly, we have worked at a more local level here in the state, particularly with the governor and his staff, to really help the legislature understand the importance of early investment in resources to prevent and end youth and young adult homelessness. And when we look at the funding here in the state as compared to the states surrounding Wisconsin, the difference is stark in terms of the lack of investment that we've been willing to make in order to ensure that more youth and young adults have improved access to housing with support. You know, the reality is homelessness is primarily caused by a lack of affordable housing. And when we talk about affordable housing, we have to talk about more housing that is more affordable for more people. And that's not a situation that is unique to Milwaukee. In fact, some of the highest rates of inaffordable housing occur in other parts of our state. And so, you know, we have to address the need for more affordable housing that is safe and accessible to folks so that once they receive housing, to David's earlier point, they are much better positioned to succeed in addressing their other unmet needs, whether that's getting and maintaining employment, securing a living wage, getting their education completed, becoming good present parents, addressing their emotional and behavioral and medical needs. Those are all things that become much more possible with the services that accompany housing but housing needs to come and be secured in advance so that those other needs can be better met.
I want to speak a little bit, if I can, to what Tim said there, the idea that flexible funding, which we have the ability to make decisions that is in the best need of our community, is really important. And I would add, not only do we need affordable housing, but we need safe and stable housing for people, especially for those youth that are in those developmental stages of their development, so that they can get a quality education, that they can move to higher education or move into training, if you will. And so for this funding to be decreased, to be cut, it really is going to mean that there's going to be more people at risk, not in the short term, perhaps, because we have a pretty strong network. But over the long term, next 3 to 5 years, we have a concern about what will happen to the numbers of people that will be out on the streets.
Well, Tim and David, thank you for helping us come closer to this issue. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
My pleasure.
David Nelson is chair of the board of directors of the Milwaukee Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. And Tim Bach is president and CEO of Pathfinders. That's a nonprofit that provides housing and clinical services to around 1,000 Milwaukee youth and young adults every year. We've been talking about potential changes to federal grants that target homelessness and what it could mean for Wisconsin services.
Coming up, a Madison indie rock band showcases the birds of Wisconsin in their new songs.
Hearing a cardinal or a sparrow and being able to pinpoint that, I think, is something that can spark joy.
The singer-songwriter from the band Quokka talks about weaving bird calls in the new album called Lifer. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The song we're hearing right now is American Robin off the album Lifer from Madison indie rock band Quokka.
The album's 10 tracks are all named after birds that we commonly see here in Wisconsin, and the songs include recordings of each bird's unique call.
Aaron Gritch is lead singer, producer, and songwriter for Quokka, and he's here to tell us more about this new album. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the album is called Lifer, and that has, from what I understand, this layered meaning. What does this word mean to you?
So to me, it means a couple of things. For one, myself, I'm a born and raised Wisconsinite, and I will be here forever. I know that much. So for myself, I am a Wisconsin lifer, but it also refers to the little badge you get on the popular Merlin birding app whenever you find a new bird, which is the tie-in to this album, an album entirely based around Wisconsin birds.
So as you get more birding experience, you know, spotting a lifer in some ways is about these rare sightings, but your album is really filled with these, you know, everyday birds that are all around us, like sparrows and cardinals and mourning doves, robins. Why did you decide to put your focus on these birds?
Yeah, I wanted it to be calls that were recognizable, things that you would walk around and hear in everyday life, especially around these parts. Because really, one of the main goals of this project is just to get people to listen while they're walking around and tune into their surroundings and maybe distinguish out a couple of the sounds, a couple of the different lives going on around you, hearing a cardinal or a sparrow and being able to pinpoint that, I think, is something that can spark joy.
Where did you find these bird calls? Are they authentic to nature?
They are all from YouTube because I could not get a decent recording. There is only one that is mine, and that is at the end of the last song. There's about a 30-second outro of chirping birds, and that is in my wife's parents' backyard. And that was a little thing that I made just for her.
What is special about birding in Wisconsin in particular?
There's so much movement throughout the year. There's the migrations that come in the fall and the spring, and just the fact that we have so many good parks and waterways around here means there's a good variety of things that come and go, not to mention the various groups around here that are excited about it and get people excited. People like Dexter Patterson areas.
BIPOC Birding Club.
Yeah, the very same. Areas like the International Crane Foundation up in Baraboo, the only one of its kind. Just, it feels like people around here are excited about the natural world and care about getting into different aspects of it.
I think I also hear in your songs how you can feel the passing of the seasons or the movement of the seasons through birds in a way. How do you feel about changing seasons and how what birds you see and how you identify the seasons with birds?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, as a Midwestern lifer, I can't live without the seasons. Like mm-hmm. that helped me mark the passage of time. But some of the birds I selected in here are written around the seasonality and movement. The first song, Northern Flicker, is about a migratory sapsucker that takes its way down to Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Zydeco country during the winter, like so many Midwesterners. Which is why I was happy to be able to fit an accordion into something to mark that. But also the Northern Cardinal, which sticks around all year and comes up to your window when nobody else will, making its call out in the middle of winter and trying to take those stories and those ideas and loop them into the way that we live as well.
Well, let's hear that first track called Northern Flicker. Let's take a listen. Northern Flickers are woodpeckers, so on a sonic level, you've got this woodpecker drumming sound in the background. How did this inform your approach to this song?
I mean, it was too cool to not put it in, and I tried to have it mimic somewhat of the FaceTime calling sound.
Okay.
Just to try to tie those two things together, and as far as the other calls go, not many other birds have a secondary percussive call to them, so something really unique about that species that I couldn't leave behind.
We're talking with Aaron Gritch, the lead singer, producer, and songwriter for the band Quokka. That's an indie band based in Madison. The newest album is called Lifer, and each track is focused on a different bird found in Wisconsin. We're going to move on to the red-winged blackbird. It's not a bird that usually gets a lot of love and attention, but you say it's your favorite. How did the red-winged blackbird win you over?
Well, it's always been my favorite from a standpoint of its time of appearance, that when you see it flying around, it's a mark that warm spring is coming, not just the robins showing up when we get fall spring and those slushy days. When you see a red-winged blackbird, it feels like there's warmth coming, and I've always loved them for that respect.
Hmm.
They are. They can be described as jerks by some. I'm sure there's a lot of people that have different stories about being swooped at in parks or on walks or that sort of thing, but I wrote this song as sort of to empathize with them as being a small creature on this earth trying to defend one small parcel that you can call yours. I think there's a lot to be said for that. Granted, red-winged blackbirds tend to make 5 or 6 or 7 different nests with 5 or 6 or 7 different partners, so maybe it's not a perfect parallel, but just a little bit more empathy for those things trying to feel safe at home.
I want to take a listen to a beloved bird here in Wisconsin, the sandhill cranes. Let's spot the call. I was thinking about the line about falling in and out of place. What comes up for you with this song?
This is something that I think was a big question for myself in my early 20s of where do I want to be in the world? And the sandhill crane is a bird that goes thousands of miles through migration every year. It's in North America, it's in South America. There's cranes in Africa and Asia, and their characteristic is just a huge amount of movement. And going all of those places and wondering if any of them truly feel like home was the big question of falling in and out of place there, and truly what makes a home when you're constantly on the move like that.
That's beautiful. My favorite song is Chickadee because it reminds me of this song, Little Bird, Little Bird, that I'd play over and over to my kids when they were little. And it's the singer-songwriter Elizabeth Mitchell, and she calls out in the song, "Who knows a bird?" And a little toddler says, "Chickadee, chickadee, fly through my window, find molasses candy.
Chickadee, chickadee, fly through my window. Chickadee, chickadee, fly through my window. Chickadee, chickadee, fly through my window. Find molasses candy."
Can you tell us a bit more about your tribute to chickadees?
Absolutely. So I wrote that song for Dexter Patterson. You know, he's an inspiration in the birding community, and I just messaged him one day and asked him what his favorite bird was while I was still picking out which ones to do. And I wrote that one, like I said, about its caching capabilities and that it's thing that it always remembers where it has seeds buried. And I thought that was just a very inspiring thing, being this little bird pretty far down the food chain as far as things go, planning for tomorrow, for next week, for next year, that it may or may not see, and the sense of optimism that it has to have imbued in it for that.
Oh, I love that so much. Aaron, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Love public radio.
That was Aaron Gritch, lead singer, producer, and songwriter for Quokka. It's an indie band based in Madison. And we've been talking about the band's new album. It's called Lifer, which has 10 songs, all written from a bird's eye view.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Trevor Hook, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.